Hello, my name is Coder Vance, and welcome to The Affairs Current. Our email is theaffairscurrent@gmail.com. Our blog, theaffairscurrent.blogspot.com, Facebook, iTunes, Twitter, all that. Coming to you today, and this is going to be a bit of a different episode, a bit of an experiment for a format. Ordinarily on this show, we like to talk about the news, but we're not really talking to the people making the news. But I think in this case, I'm going to try basically interviewing somebody who's involved in something that in Ottawa that is a really interesting story about labor organization, about workers' rights in the modern day. And you've heard him on the show before, but he's coming back to us not as a panelist, but I guess as an interviewee this time. It's Miles. How are you doing today, Miles?
I'm well, Carter. Thanks. Good to be back.
And just to, maybe for people who didn't listen to the previous episode you were on, could you just give people kind of an idea of who you are, what you do as far as your career and life and all that kind of thing?
Sure, yeah. So I'm a graduate student at Carleton University, doing a master's in political economy, namely one that focuses, my thesis focuses on left political strategy and sort of what the implications for left political strategy are given the increasing inequality in rich market democracies. But we won't get into that. I'm a teaching assistant at Carleton University as well, and I'm also the co-vice president of Unit 1, which represents the teaching assistants at the QP 4600 local. So part of the labor movement in that way, in fact, that was my first time being in a union, was becoming a teaching assistant at Carleton. And outside of that, I'm also a delegate to the Ottawa District Labor Council here in Ottawa, and there's a struggle going on there. And maybe you'll want to touch on that at some point as well. Yeah, that's about it.
Okay. But for the purposes of this discussion, what we kind of want to focus on is some of the efforts that Miles has been working on to unionize the Ottawa area wine rack stores. Right. And then more specifically, his dispute with the employer regarding his dismissal from that company as a result of these efforts. So I guess if you want to kind of walk the listeners through your experience to this point, being an employee of the wine rack and attempting to do this labor organization, because we should point out that I believe, and correct me if I'm wrong here, that the Toronto area wine rack stores are unionized, right, but the Ottawa area stores are not unionized. So just sort of describe your time as an employee there and your time trying to organize a union there, and what ultimately happened that led us to where we are now.
Sure, yeah. So, I mean, given my introduction, it's going to sound like I was a salter going in, which is salting is a term, for those who don't know, for people who join workforces with the explicit intention to unionize them. It's a strategy. Now, that's not actually what happened in my case. I desperately needed a job when the summer began, last summer, because TA ships only last during the fall and winter terms. And so basically, I needed a job, and I wasn't finding one in the usual places. I've been slinging beers for the past 7 years now. A job wasn't forthcoming at a restaurant or bar, and I started getting desperate and applying to places like Wine Rack. And I got a job at Wine Rack, and everything was going well enough, I suppose. It was, it's sort of an unfortunate job in a lot of ways. It's minimum wage, so I hadn't been making that little money since I was working as a sandwich artist at Subway when I was 16. Like, it had been a very long time since I was back to making that little money. And the way that the scheduling was done there was also just added to the precarity of the work, because it was part-time and the scheduling was not static. So it ended up being the situation where I finally got a job and I was able to pay the bills, but just barely. And, it was, I would be working anywhere from 14 to 30-hour weeks. And the shifts would always change. And they'd never give you more than 5 hours, so that they wouldn't have to provide you with a break. So everybody at the shop that I was at least, would work either 3, 4, or 5 hour shifts. Often it was a mix of the three. And, you know, what that means is that any given week, your time's monopolized because there's these little chunks of time that you have to work each day. It varies each day. It makes it very hard, therefore, to get supplementary work to supplement your wages. It means that the kind of job you're going to be able to find, you have to find to supplement your wages, is another kind of shitty job like that, where the schedule is all over the place, you know, odd hours and that sort of thing. You know, aside from that, I started learning about who Weinrack was while I was working there. A lot of it was just out of curiosity, because I came to realize that the store managers weren't getting treated very well either, and they were also making very low wages without benefits. It's $15 an hour, what it amounts to, is what for store managers, and they're managing the entire shop. And it's just, you know, there's this hierarchy, fairly rigid hierarchy in place. So I did some Googling, and I found out that Weinrack's owned by Constellation Brands, which is the largest wine corporation in the world, which strikes people as, it always surprises people, because people look at the Weinrack. Actually, there was this funny article that Ottawans are aware of that was in the New York Times. Somebody had come from the New York Times to do a review of, I guess, the city of Ottawa and the highlights and whatever. And the person was visiting the market, and they said the number one place they saw in the market was the Weinrack, this really cool local, you know, retailer of wine. And everybody in Ottawa laughed, because they knew that Weinrack's just this big chain, right? And it's nothing to do with Ottawa, the market. You know, it could be plopped down anywhere. What people don't realize, however, is that Weinrack is not just an Ontario chain, and it's not a Canadian chain. I mean, it is a Canadian chain, but it's owned by a massive American corporation. This, in fact, the largest wine corporation. And it's an interesting situation. I haven't actually looked into, you know, the provincial legislation that allows them to have this monopolistic place in Ontario's wine market. From what I can gather, it just has to do with the fact that they, you know, if you're going to sell wine outside the LCBO, you have to own the winery to do that. So people can sell wine outside the LCBO, but it's because they own the wineries and they're making the wine. So Constellation Brands is able to have an LCBO-like storefront for wine because they actually own every single winery of all the different wines they're selling there. So they're able to do business because they're massive. And
so do you think that's kind of them exploiting kind of a loophole in the law? Because, you know, the point of, as I understand it, the reason that law is written that way is to allow, you know, on-site sales at wineries, yeah. Situations where, you know, smaller local wineries in the Niagara region and things like that. So do you think that's kind of a situation where somebody's exploiting a loophole in the law to, as you say, grant them this sort of monopoly over the non-LCBO wine market?
Yeah, I think it's partly that. I mean, there's obviously blame to be placed on the government as well, right? It's not like they're unaware of the situation. And there's clearly a trend of favoring the giant businesses over the local smaller businesses in the alcohol market. I mean, even with the Liberals' policy now to extend alcohol sales to grocery stores, it's not the small local grocers that are getting this opportunity. It's the Weston family. It's, you know, it's huge grocers that are getting this opportunity. And the beer store still remains, you know, in a monopolistic position as well.
Yeah. And I mean, I think that's something that maybe some people are sort of confused about, both the beer store and the wine rack. I think sometimes people think of them as branches of the LCBO. Yeah. But of course, the LCBO, you know, obviously people have various criticisms of it, but at least in terms of employment practices for retail anyway, the LCBO workers are paid reasonably well. Mm-hmm. They do have more control over the shift scheduling, et cetera, et cetera. So I think, and both the beer store and the wine rack privately owned, and they don't have to abide by those contracts. So I think that's just something very important to point out to people there.
Yeah, and the beer store actually is unionized.
The beer store is unionized. Okay,
excuse me.
They are
getting a better deal. They do have collective agreements where they've established higher wages and benefits for themselves. You know, Wine Rack really stands alone here. And like, as you mentioned already, the Toronto Wine Racks are actually organized with SEIU Local 2, which I guess is a good segue into my story. So I became, you know, familiar with a lot of this stuff while I was working there, because to be honest, it was one of the most degrading jobs I've had in a long time. It was one of the lowest paying jobs I've had in a really long time. And, you know, the way that they treat, because of the hierarchical management structure, I think there's this built-in sort of disrespect, that the store managers are being disrespected, and it's easier for them to sort of displace that disrespect onto their subordinates. Sort of this, what I've heard referred to as the bicycling effect. Everybody's got their heads down, pedaling, kicking the people below them. You know, this is the sort of atmosphere, at least in my shop. I mean, I'm sure it varies by shop. I've met some really excellent store managers, especially since starting the campaign, who are very supportive of their subordinates' efforts to unionize, which is very interesting because you'd expect a giant corporation to keep their management loyal, and they're not able to do that because they don't treat them very well, the lower rungs very well at all, including management. So anyways, I became aware of, I wanted to, I started considering unionization when I started feeling sort of fed up with the conditions there. And it wasn't just me. I mean, I was looking at other workers who were working at the Wine Rack who aren't grad students like me, who have a TA job to fall back on in the fall and what have you, and you know, maybe a bar job. There's people who are raising families working at the Wine Rack. There's people who, you know, have kids that they're trying to, allow them to participate in sports and obviously paying the bills. And it's just, it's brutal. Like, I could barely get by, and I didn't have that sort of situation with those dependents in my life. So, you know, it angered me to realize that there's people really struggling to get by here, and they don't need to. I mean, the Wine Rack is the exception. All the other retail storefronts that are dispensing alcohol are unionized. They have better deals for their workers. So, and then added to that, we were just talking about, I mean, this large American corporation has come into this province or bought up all the wineries in this province. I think they bought out Vincor, which was already a Canadian corporation that owned a lot of these wineries. Nonetheless, I mean, they're in this market, and they're profiting huge from this monopoly position that they have, largely thanks to the particular legislation that's in place in this province. So our own representatives have set up this situation, unwittingly or not, that's extremely beneficial to this large American corporation. The least they could do, you'd think, is pay the average wages that are being paid to our peers and the beer store and at the LCBO. You know, pay their Canadian workers a decent wage, and they're not. You know, and putting this all in perspective, it motivated me. It really motivated me to try to do something about it. And so I found out that Toronto Wine Racks were unionized with SEIU, which is Service Employees International Union. Yeah, a big American union. Yeah. They're doing fantastic work in America and Canada right now on the fight for 15.
Yeah, just to if people are aware, they're of course very active in a lot of different service sectors. Very famously, the Justice for Janitors campaign was run by SEIU. There's actually, in fact, a movie about that with Adrian Brody in it, which is pretty good, called Bread and Roses, which is about the Justice for Janitors campaign. So just to say, they are one of the largest and fastest growing unions in America, kind of an exception to the rule in that way.
Right.
Anyway, so we continue.
Yeah, and that's, you know, the organizer I was working with here, fantastic organizer. He's doing the Justice for Janitors campaign here, and they're actually making a lot of progress. You know, they've signed on a whole bunch of different federal buildings here to the SEIU. And so things are happening for them, and they're doing great work. The Fight for 15 is a fantastic campaign, and really it's something that the entire labor movement should be, you know, very clearly getting behind, but there's a lot of silence coming from, or if not silence, in action from other unions. That being said, SEIU, I came to learn, has some serious flaws. And what's really interesting about this campaign of mine, or this, you know, my trying to get involved with this union, basically just my efforts to unionize the shop, is that I've learned a lot about the labor movement and unions and their structure and how important it is, these differences in structure. So the SEIU, despite the great work they're doing, organizing precarious workers, which is not happening from a lot of the big unions, their organizational structure is not, as I came to conclude, conducive to the empowerment of workers, or not very conducive to that. The problem with SEIU is, and this is the problem with a couple other unions, from what I understand, is that they have a local structure in place where they have these oxymoronic locals. They're national locals. So they only have two locals in the entire country. And they're both headquartered in Toronto. Now, what that means is that at the local level, they don't have locals. They have bargaining units. And in bargaining units, the structure is quite different. So if I was to organize successfully with SEIU, Local 2, it would mean that we didn't have our own bank account where our dues were kept locally. We wouldn't have our own executive. We would have two pseudo-executive members, a recording secretary and a president. You know, the meetings of of these two executives probably wouldn't be that lively and encouraging, I would imagine. But really the big problem is you'd have to phone Toronto. You'd have to phone the executive in Toronto if you wanted to fight a grievance, if you wanted money to have a holiday party, if you needed to print flyers, if you to build to mobilize, to build solidarity amongst your rank and file. I mean, it would be, I think it would be really alienating for a lot of people to come to realize that, like, after this huge struggle locally to form a union, all of a sudden, you know, there's not really a local structure in place. And the even worse is that the local in Toronto, the wine rack, the wine merchants, or any local workplace that had less than 100, I think it's 120 people, they don't qualify for their representative on the local executive in Toronto. They would have to share one representative with basically every other workplace in the country that had under 120 workers. And seeing as wine rack would be close to that number, but just below that number, it's, you know, you can see how it'd be even more of a factor of why.
So it's sort of a problem with just, well, as you're saying, the structure, but then the whole thing of, you know, the SEIU is active in a lot of different workplaces, and some of them, you know, like a big hotel or something like that is going to have, you know, well over 120 employees, but a wine rack is not going to have that many, so.
And even the hotel, you know, would get one representative on an executive in Toronto that has, I who knows how many representatives, but I'm sure it's pretty bloated at this point if it's representing the people from across the country. So, you know, your voice is going to get drowned out necessarily. Like, it's just, it's too bad because they have the best organizers in the city, as far as I can tell. They're doing great work. The people who are working for them are great people. But this structural problem. And, you know, it's funny because now I'm with the industrial workers of the world, the Wobblies, as they're popularly known, and they have their own structural problems, you know, on the other, but totally the other direction. So I'm, you know, I'm trying to find, I came into this situation sort of naively. Just to put this in context, I'm, as I already mentioned, I'm a member of the QP 4600. The teaching assistants union at Carleton. Now, the situation there, I think, is ideal. We have a lot of membership, mind you, but nonetheless, there's locals that have 40, 50 people, there's even less. But our local has somewhere over 3,000. Anyways, we have a local at Carleton where, you know, we have our own executive, we have a whole bunch of money in the bank, we have all our dues there, and we, you know, people can come together at our general membership meetings. And we can decide how to spend this money and what to do. And we have, you know, we have three employees, for example. We've hired a full-time mobilization coordinator, a full-time business agent, part-time data entry worker. So, you know, there's this huge organization locally. And we can do all this mobilization work. And we are doing all this mobilization work. And I can see it, you know, working. It's you know, it's inspiring to work with the QP 4600.
So I guess I guess just if we want to maybe back up slightly. So you're trying to go through SEIU, yeah. Trying to see about unionizing the store. Now, the first question I kind of want to ask you is because were you in that process made aware of any, let's say, previous attempts at unionization of the Ottawa Wine Racks? And if you were, could you speak to how those went and why they didn't go through, if you are aware of that?
Well, as you know, I am, Carter, because a mutual friend of ours who works at my shop, or my former shop, had been involved with the previous attempt to unionize Wine Rack. Now, I get the feeling there's been a few, more than just this one that's come to my attention through our mutual acquaintance. I've asked him about what the union was, who they were trying to organize with, and he actually doesn't remember anymore who it was. But they were having troubles with the organizer not willing to participate very much in the organization, in the campaign. And, their problem was just they encountered a lot of apathy and an apathetic organizer, but also an apathetic workforce. Which is something I've struggled with as well, trying to organize Wine Rack. So there was an attempt, but it ultimately fizzled out. Basically, the organizer wasn't willing to do a lot of work, and then the person who initiated the drive, I think, got another job or ended up quitting, and after that, it just fizzled out. Now, interestingly enough, the fellow I'm working with from the Industrial Workers of the World now, his he used to work at the Wine Rack years and years ago, maybe a decade ago. And this was, I think, the first time he was interested in forming a union. And I think he took steps to organize Wine Rack, or there was something going on in terms of unionizing Wine Rack at the time when he was there as well. This is a common story, I think. There's lots of attempts at unionization at different workplaces, but it's not like it's a part of history anywhere. It's not written down. There's not a record of this. So you kind of hear from people about things that had happened in the past, attempts that had been made in the past, but there's no institutional memory because they were never successful.
And then I guess maybe a bit of follow-up to that is in speaking with the SEIU about this, did they kind of convey to you why and what the process was to getting the Toronto Wine Racks unionized, and maybe if you could speak to why that was a successful drive versus Ottawa, where it wasn't necessarily?
They didn't even know. It was news to them that they had organized the Toronto Wine Racks. So when I told them that they had organized the Toronto Wine Racks, that's when they knew. The Ottawa SEIU was unaware. I mean, this speaks to the problems with this structure here. They not only were they not really aware that had happened, when I pushed them to get me in touch with somebody from the Toronto Wine Racks, they couldn't find anybody. Now, Toronto Wine Rack, the Toronto Wine Racks must employ hundreds of people. I mean, Ottawa has probably just under 100 employees. But Toronto's huge. They have way more locations. There's got to be hundreds of people working there. They couldn't get me in touch with a single person. And they couldn't even get me a copy of the collective agreement for the longest time. So there's you can see the underrepresentation of a bargaining unit, having effects here. Like, and when I finally did get a hand of get a hold of the collective agreement, they had made gains. But they were really paltry gains. It was really depressing, collective agreement. It's one of these typical provisions you read in a collective agreement. They had full benefits, pretty comprehensive benefits, but only for full-time employees. Now, I don't know if this was always the case. In fact, I've heard that it wasn't always the case. But in Ottawa Wine Racks, almost everybody's part-time. I don't think it used to be that way always, and maybe this is why it isn't this way now, is that they had a union in Toronto, and so they just got rid of full-time employees so they didn't have to pay benefits to anybody. This is the situation with the Toronto Wine Rack. They have a slight, very, very little increase in wages. They do have a better pay scale, but the amounts are bigger, but it's still not based on seniority. So they've got huge issues there with their collective agreement. And from what I understand, It's because there was almost no engagement at the local level there. They had like two people show up to ratify the collective agreement out of hundreds. So, you know, what I'm worried about is finding a union whose organizational structure is such that it's conducive to people becoming activists in their workplace, who conducive to people feeling empowered and having a structure there where they can, at least at some point, get involved, right, and create this sort of community.
And I guess you kind of touched on it a bit earlier, but you're now involved with Industrial Workers of the World, who, of course, are known as a more radical sort of union that, you know, Noam Chomsky's affiliated with them, etc.
Yeah. Well,
but you also said that there is some
anarchist union in North America.
Some, an anarchist union. But you also said that you found some structural problems there in the opposite direction. I'm wondering if it doesn't, you know, if it's not going to create problems there, could you maybe elaborate on that a little
sure.
bit?
No, I'd love to. I mean, I was up front with the Wobblies from the start about what I thought the drawbacks were with their structure and, you know, what I was willing to do, therefore, as a result. So they know, for example, I've been up front with them that I'm not going to unionize, I'm not going to organize with them. But the reason I went to them in the first place, I didn't actually know they were operating locally, which I thought was really cool when I found that out. So the reason I went with them is because I heard that they would represent individuals, and they often were representing individuals, and that they were very much involved in direct action tactics, you know, sort of because philosophically they identify with those tactics, but also, you know, there's a need. There's all sorts of instances where individuals have lost their job for dubious reasons, or people are having their wages stolen, and they'll reach out to the Wobblies, and they'll step in. You know, they'll get one. You can sign up a card whether your workforce is unionized or not, right? So you can join up with the Wobblies, and they'll support you, which is exactly what I did. So I signed up with them. But yeah, I mean, here's the thing. The Industrial Workers of the World is obviously an international union. And so what's happened is they've, I think this is largely thanks to American membership, but they voted, the different locals voted to not allow IWW to sign collective agreements if they include a no-strike clause or a gag clause. Now, in Ontario law, every collective agreement has a no-strike clause in it during the terms of a collective agreement. Therefore, the Industrial Workers of the World will not sign a collective agreement in this province. So even if I wanted to get a collective agreement with the Wobblies, I can't, unless for some reason, you know, that was mysteriously left out of the CA, which is impossible. Now, what they are willing to do, sorry?
Now, is that thing about the collective agreements and the no strike clause, is that due to Ontario labor law,
yes,
or is that just something that is in every collective agreement in Ontario?
No, that's due to labor law.
That's due to labor law,
yeah,
okay.
So there's really nothing, you know, Ontarians can do about that aside from push their government to change the law. But in the meantime, I mean, a bunch of precarious workers, what are they supposed to do? Write a letter to their MP asking them to change the law so they can organize with the Wobblies? Now, of course, the Wobblies do have an alternative way of organizing. They will organize through contract law. It's actually this very interesting thing. I read a piece in the Jacobin recently that was making arguments about how there's a public teachers union is going to the Supreme Court, and they're sort of hoping that Justice Scalia and some others on the Supreme Court side in their favor because what hangs in the balance is what's it called? The Rand Formula.
Well, it's basically the idea of, yeah, just to briefly touch on that, it's basically the idea of mandatory union dues,
exactly.
Or, well, not even mandatory union dues, but these mandatory representation fees that exist in lieu of union dues in some of these cases, and that's what's being challenged in the court case.
Right. And the article in the Jacobin was interesting because it was basically arguing from a Wobbly perspective. I don't know if the person who wrote it was a Wobbly or not. But it was saying, like, you know, what are we going to do if the law is not there for us anymore? Like, this is why we need to have activist unions in the first place. Like, and this is what the Wobblies will tell you. And I think they're, you know, there's a lot of merit to this argument. They're saying, you know, you need to just build solidarity in your workplace and have an activist workforce that's committed to really committed to socialism at the end of the day, and committed to the labor movement. And, you know, then it doesn't matter. We can just sign contracts. We can do contract law. Like, we don't need collective agreements. You know, and this all sounds pretty good on paper, but I was pretty concerned about, you know, the feasibility of this, at least.
So you think it's just sort of like you would agree with it, maybe philosophically speaking, in an ideal world kind of thing, but they're not really recognizing the reality of what Ontario labor law is and how it functions? Is that sort of what I'm reading?
Yeah, well, the thing for what I would say is that they're not mutually exclusive things. I mean, I think you need to, in the Ontario context, I think it'd be best to get a collective agreement. I think it'd be best to have the union form even before building those, you know, that critical political consciousness in your rank and file. Because, I mean, I see it at Carleton. At QP 4600, people get involved with the union because something happened to them, let's say. They had a grievance or whatever. A friend brought them out to an event and they somehow they got involved with the executive or some union event on campus. And that's what radicalizes people. That's what produces a broader understanding of labor, the labor movement. That's what produces a political consciousness in people that I've seen, right? So it's a bit of putting a cart before the horse, I guess. I think in this scenario, I don't think it's one way. I don't think one has to come before the other. I think they both should interact with each other. I mean, it's, you should pursue both. You should try to be building an activist union, and that's not that doesn't have to happen outside of the RAND formula or a collective agreement. But in this case with them, it does, because of this, you know, their principled stance against no strike clauses not being legitimate. I think that's, but like I said, there was lots of Canadian Wobbly representatives that voted against that because they said, hey, that's not practical here because of the situation legally.
Now let's kind of, I kind of want to go through here and get to really the meat of what's going on now. So you're attempting this unionization drive, and then you were unfairly dismissed from the wine rack. So could you outline what happened there?
Yeah, well, basically I'd been trying to organize with the SEIU, and we'd been visiting shops. I had made flyers, with information about Constellation Brands and why people should be interested in unionizing. And, I was going to visit different shops and talking to different wine merchants and giving them the literature. I that was happening for a while, and then we started getting people to sign cards. So we were going out to shops again and getting cards signed, and it was going pretty well. But when we visited one shop, somebody was asking about the dues. They were really skeptical about the benefits of a union, and they were asking about the structure of the union and asking about dues. And anyways, I realized that I didn't actually have the answer, and so I wanted to be more prepared. So I took the constitution of the SEIU and I read it. And this is when I realized how bad the organizational structure was. And it made me feel like, oh man, it almost made me feel like the SEIU is, approximates the caricature of unions that the corporation offers you and, the union business thing. I mean, they're not, they're better than that. I mean, that's a caricature of unions. But really, if you look at the Toronto Wine Merchant Collective Agreement, they didn't really get much out of it, and the SEIU is still collecting dues. You know, basically their wage increase is about the equivalent of the dues they pay. So they're not really getting a higher wage; they're just paying dues. Do you see what I'm saying? You take that reality and you read one of these anti-union screeds that the employer posts in the workplace.
Yeah, we should kind of point out that people may have seen on, I think it was featured on rankandfile.ca recently, or at least their Facebook page, and it's kind of been passed around, this anti-union flyer that was put up by Constellation Brands at the Ottawa Wine Rack. So,
at my workplace,
as a result of your efforts.
Yeah, that was the photo of the one at my workplace, and I've spoken to we've spoken to the manager that actually posted it there. And that's a part of our, the investigation's been really enlightening and really interesting. Some of the evidence we've been able to marshal, it doesn't look good for the employer, I think, at this point, given the statements we have from former management. Basically, they were circulating video of me. Once I started visiting shops, somebody, I guess, told somebody And so management became aware, and so they were able to track down a video of me and the fellow from SEIU, and so they were circulating that amongst themselves, trying to find out where, what shop I came from, and who I was. And eventually, I'm pretty sure they ultimately did, because after I was fired for very dubious reasons, one of the mid-level managers who did the firing, after he did the firing and was talking to a colleague of his, I believe so, one of his superiors, his response was, "Oh, good, we got the union organizer." And then pretty much immediately after, within the next 2 to 3 days, I became aware that there was an anti-union poster posted at my shop. All signs point to me being fired for organizing, which is of course an illegal thing to do. It's against the labor law, but it's also infringing the rights of the charter.
Yeah, and I just want to kind of outline. So, what was the ostensible reason that you were given why you were fired? Because as you point out, it is of course illegal to fire somebody for attempting to organize a workplace. So, what was the justification given there?
Well, it's a bit of a long story. I'll try to make it concise. Basically, the way things work at my shop is scheduling changes are completed in red pen over top of a penciled in schedule that the manager makes, right? The reason for that is so that it's evident that the schedule has been changed, and that you can actually see the original time as well. You're not supposed to erase the schedule. Now, I don't actually know whether the manager had done this on. I think he just is hapless. I think he just screwed up and had arbitrary policies he makes up on the go. And anyways, what happened was he changed my schedule. He erased the pencil, wrote in new pencil, didn't tell me. The schedule had already been posted for weeks. You know, I had a photo of it that I'd written it down on my own calendar. But the last week before my shift, it had been changed all of a sudden. And no notification happened. There was no red pen. So I inevitably I missed this shift. And I get a phone call from the store manager that day saying, you know, "Where are you? You've missed your shift." So I run over there and I end up working for free for like an hour. And I actually get angry. The manager's trying to blame it on me when I get there. And I just turn it around on him. "Are you kidding me? If anything, you owe me 3 hours right now. Change my shift." You know, I had this part of my day was set aside to work here. And now I'm not getting those hours of work that I need. And so I was able to sort of turn it around confidently enough that the manager was in a position where he was apologizing. And that was the end of that. And then a couple days later, he presented me with this progressive discipline report. And on that report, it said, "Look, you missed your shift. The only consequence of this is that you're getting a verbal warning and you're going to sign this progressive discipline report." And so I noticed, however, on the report, it didn't mention that it was basically entirely the manager's fault that I wasn't there. And so I insisted there's a comment section for employees. So I said, "I'm going to write in that you screwed up here, and then I'll sign off on it." And he was resisting that, but eventually he acquiesced, and I signed off on a report with the details that were left out in addition. And that was that. And then everything was fine. I hadn't heard about it. We didn't hear about it again until 2 or 3 weeks later. One of the higher up managers came in and fired me at the start of my shift. I showed up to work and there was a manager there that I hadn't met before, and they said, "You're being fired for this reason." I said, "That doesn't make any sense." The explanation is, I said, "It's literally incoherent, this this rationale." And the manager said, "Yeah, you're right, it is, but I'm just doing my job." And that was that. So this is the story. I think the most listeners will agree it sounds pretty dubious.
So that occurred. Now, when did that occur? What time was that you were dismissed there?
It was about a week and a half, I think, after I had missed the shift. I missed the shift on August 30th, and I believe it was September 6th or 7th.
This is last fall that yes. this happened. Okay, so since then,
crucial point here that I should mention. Is that I had already pushed away SEIU, right? So I had no one to turn to. I had basically pushed SEIU away about a week earlier, saying, like, look, I don't think you guys are great, but I just don't feel like wine merchants are going to be empowered with the structure that they're being given with SEIU. And that was fine, and everything was amended, like, you know, it was friendly. And then this happens, right? So there was nobody to go to. And at first I just figured, well, I guess that's it. I'm screwed. But after a couple of weeks of thinking about it was when I started trying to get in touch with the Wobblies, and then it's been this drawn-out process ever since then.
Okay. So, yeah, that's kind of what I wanted to get to, is that, as you put it, drawn-out process. So could you – so after the dismissal, kind of what started happening from there? Because people may have seen you out front of some of the wine racks recently, protesting, picketing, but kind of – and this was, you know, only for the last couple of weeks, so maybe kind of walk us from September to today.
Well, there was the very slow, I mean, I took a while to reach out. I don't know actually how long it took me to get in touch with the Wobblies. But when I did, things were moving really slowly. And kind of understandably, really, because the Wobblies are in Ottawa are, you know, it's a group of really, really great people, first of all, but second of all, just committed activists, but it's a small group, you know, and this is all volunteer stuff they're doing for me, somebody they'd never met before, and somebody who evidently disagrees with some of their political strategy. So it's really magnanimous, and I think it really speaks to the their character that they're doing so much to help me now. But nonetheless, it's a bit of a slow-moving process because it's, the activism of a handful of people that are pushing this forward. So just making the unfair labor practice report, you know, you have to conduct an investigation, you have to interview my coworkers, former managers, you have to fill out, quite a decent amount of paperwork that actually involves a lot of detail.
Now, is that with the Ontario Labor Relations Board that you do that? Okay, yeah.
Yeah, so we're filing that paperwork. That should be sent in any day now. It's probably going to be sent in tomorrow. We're just waiting on a couple of people to sign off on the interviews. The notes that we've taken from the interviews. And once that happens, though, it's going to be another, you know, who knows, several months before anything actually comes of it. So in the meantime, what's happened is because the Wobblies are believe in direct action as an effective tactic, and you know, that's part of what informs their philosophy, I think. We've sent a letter of demands to the employer. We've contacted the employer already, saying reinstate me with back pay, and we're putting pressure on them to meet those demands, or at least to come to the table and talk to us. By picketing their storefronts. So we've picketed my old shop now twice. It's been pretty great. I mean, a lot of people have been turned away from the wine rack. A lot of people are, it's the first time they're finding out that the wine rack isn't an Ontario business. It's actually this huge American thing. It's the first time they're, you know, contemplating, a lot of people, it's the first time they're contemplating that it's a monopoly. It's the first time they're contemplating that the workers here are not being treated like the workers at the other places they go. So it was great. I mean, a lot of people cross the picket line and go in and get their wine anyways, but we've been turning away a lot of people as well. And that's been
yeah. So I guess that was kind of my next question, is what has the response from the public been like, through you doing this picketing? But I guess you already kind of answered that, but
well,
if you have any more to add there.
There hasn't really been any animus. It's been either people who just don't want anything to do, like they just don't want to know, they just want to duck their head and go get their wine and not talk to us. And then it's people who we've talked to that, you know, maybe they don't really understand what the implications of crossing a picket line are, or, you know, know a lot about the labor movement. But people have been really responsive. And I think because it's so clearly the asymmetry, and just the injustice is so clear that it's been great. I mean, we've been we're a good picket line too, because we sing songs. I've created songbooks, and a lot of people who don't know the Wobblies maybe don't know this, but the Wobblies have a huge tradition of music, right? The Big Red Book is just a collection of tons and tons of songs written by Wobblies. The most famous songwriter for the Wobblies is, of course, Joe Hill, who a lot of people will recognize from, probably from hearing the Pete Seeger song about Joe Hill. But, you know, this Swedish person that emigrated to America and was ultimately killed by the American government, set framed and put to death. But yeah, there's a huge tradition of music in the Wobblies, and I'm somebody who loves loves labor music and union songs. So I've been taking full advantage of that. So we had a songbook we put together, and we're not just doing chants. We've been singing songs. Actually, Edward will tell you this, because your co-host joined me in the first picket line, and he was singing with us. And actually, it's funny because a lady from the Ottawa Citizen showed up, a journalist from the Ottawa Citizen showed up and took a photo of the picket line. But she liked Edward's sign the best, so she got Edward to stop in the middle of the picket and took a picture of Edward with the IWW flag in the background and all these wobbly signs everywhere. And I said, Edward, if this makes the paper, you're going to be you're going to be identified as an Ottawa anarchist. How do you feel about this? I haven't seen anything in The Citizen yet.
No, I think so. So I guess that kind of covers that. So I guess if you have any more to add about where things stand at the moment, I do have a couple more questions I want to ask you, but just if you want to add anything right now about where things stand right now.
Well, I mean, we haven't really heard from the employer, so I think they're just hoping this goes away. I'm not sure it will. I mean, obviously it depends on the people who are around me and that are willing to support me, so I can't control that. But I think we're going to keep at this for a while yet. And as you know, my roommates are the Ottawa's folk duo, the Moonfruits. And I think if it drags out till when they get back from their honeymoon, we're just going to have an even louder voice on that picket line. So I don't think they realize it, but things are going to continue on, at least for the short to medium term.
Perfect. And I guess the one last thing I wanted to ask you a little bit about was this issue you spoke about a little bit earlier, the Ottawa District Labor Council.
Yeah.
I guess just wanted to, if you have things to say about that, now would be the time to add that in.
Yeah, well, actually, I will say something about that in a minute, perhaps. It's another story. Something that's pertinent to this story we've been telling here that I forgot to mention is what am I doing now about organizing? Because of course I'm not organizing with the Wobblies due to their structure, and I'm not organizing with the SEIU. So what am I doing? We are still organizing, and I want listeners to know that. But right now there was two options there are two options that are in front of me, and one is quite interesting. It's the potential of just forming an independent, a new union. Which it turns out is not that hard to do. All you need to do is have a constitution and a member, like a couple members that show up to a meeting where minutes are being taken, and they vote to accept the constitution, and that's pretty much it. And then you make cards and get people to sign them. So that's still very much a live option, but there's a lot of drawbacks to this form of this method of organizing, because you don't have the bigger structure behind
institutional backing of a major union. Yeah.
And, you know, let's say the union's formed, but there's not a lot of people willing to step up and actually run the day-to-day operations of the union. It could, you know, whoever is in that position of president or whatever, the active executive members have a lot of work on their hands that they can't pass off to the national or provincial organization. There is none, right? It would just be those workers. So, you know, one of the things I'm considering now is, if, you know, do I really want to get myself into something like an independent, a new union? It could end up being overwhelming. I'm trying to write a thesis right now, for God's sakes, on political strategy. I should try not to live it so much and actually try to be able to contemplate it and write about it as well, right? The other option is we're looking at OPSU right now, who organizes the LCBO. Now, of course, they're a public sector union, but...
Yes. And actually, I should perhaps say in the interest of full disclosure that I am a member of OPSU.
Oh.
Through my... When I worked at Ontario Public Service a couple of years ago, I'm still a card-carrying member of OPSU, so...
Okay, Brother Carter.
Anyway, yeah, so you're looking at OPSU as an option,
yeah,
as well.
And that's what's happening now, is I've been one of the Wobblies I've spoken to in the area does organizing work, or does work with OPSU, and so I'm considering getting in touch with them. And, you know, things are going forward. So if anybody's listening who happens to be a wine merchant and is interested in the prospect of a union, that we're still looking to do something along those lines.
Yeah, and I guess we should say right here, if people want to reach out to you and get involved with this, if they are either a wine merchant in Ottawa or they just support what you're doing and like to find out more about it, how can they get in contact with you? And I'll put the links up if there are specific links to the blog, but how would they go about doing that?
Best way is the Facebook page right now. Wine Merchants Unite, Ottawa Wine Merchants Unite. Sorry, and that's on Facebook. Yeah, and you can direct message the Facebook page from there. You know, if you're worried that you're a wine merchant and you're worried about you don't want to like the page in case the employer can see that on your Facebook profile or whatever. Just direct message the page. There's no way to track that. And then from there we can get into touch through other means. I have a mail list as well, but yeah, that's the best point of entry is through the Facebook page.
Okay, perfect. So I guess if you could maybe just say, like, what do you think your experience thus far as somebody who's, you know, studied labor movements and has been involved with QP at Carleton as well, but what do you think your experience in this service-based sector, where, you know, unions traditionally have had difficulty organizing and all that kind of thing, what do you think your experience has really taught you about the labor movement in the, you know, the modern economy, I suppose?
You know, Carter, that's a great question. I'm really glad you asked that. A couple things have come to mind, you know. One thing that I often say this to people who have, skeptical views about union or anti-union views, you know, that unions are flawed institutions, and they're sometimes corrupt, you know. And what's interesting is this is also true of political parties, you know. And if you look at the NDP, it strikes me as a similar organization in many ways to QP or to some of the big unions. And, you know, it's interesting because I meet a lot of people who are labor activists who are willing to fight for these institutions or fight within these institutions to make them better and to, you know, to fulfill the promises of organized labor, of the labor movement. And interestingly, they're very hesitant to do the same for something like the NDP. But I think it's an interesting analog, though, you know, that these are actually very similar things. And I would, you know, I don't want to get into the partisan politics too much, but it does make me wonder why people are so reluctant to get involved with one and not the other. So there's that. The other thing I've come to realize is that, yeah, there's a really big problem insofar as there's not organized labor is not actively organizing precarious workers enough. I mean, some SEIU is making some efforts on this front, but there's really not enough being done. And actually, to tie this in with the ODLC, you can see that in the Ottawa District Labor Council, the executive is all gray-haired people, mostly men, mostly white men. You know, old white dudes is pretty much the executive of the Ottawa District Labor Council. And, you know, that's, I think, indicative of the fact that there's not the people who work precarious jobs are not very well represented. Young people, women, people who are racialized people, they're not there. And
do you think this is kind of causing an alienation between the two groups, people who could in their workplaces, you know, benefit from being organized, being unionized, are saying, oh, well, because the face of labor is, as you put it, these old white men. Yeah. They're not seeing their own struggles being represented in those institutions, so they think, oh, well, you know, they're not going to represent me, why bother, kind of thing.
Well, I think it's... that's probably part of it. I think a big part of it is that the labor movement's been on the defensive for a really long time. So there's a lot of, you know, a lot of the actions I see coming out of the Ottawa District Labor Council, but the labor movement generally are defensive actions. And they're often focused on their own membership, which is, you know, sort of not surprising. But there's a larger principle here that I think some people are losing sight of. In the labor movement, or have lost sight of. It's interesting, actually, because my mom was a member of the Catholic School Teachers Union. I don't actually remember what their acronym is, but she was a Catholic school teacher, elementary school teacher, and she was part of their union. And I remember this is one of the few arguments I've ever won with my mother, but she was upset because her union had made a donation to picketing workers who were on strike at the airport. And, you know, I said to her, have you shown up to the meetings? Did you hear what the justifications were? Did you, you know, do you know the history? Had the airport workers maybe contributed to your local when your local was in trouble? Like, is there a relationship there? You know, and what about this principle of solidarity? If it doesn't extend beyond one local, one union, it just becomes, you know, enlightened self-interest, no better than enlightened self-interest. You know, we're only interested about us and our, it's tribalism even at a certain point when, if people lose sight of the larger labor movement. So I think there's been, you know, because of the defensive posture a lot of unions have had to take in the last several decades has led to that sort of mentality or just, you know, people not seeing beyond their own membership anymore. This social unionism has been on the...
So I guess just to maybe sum up there, you think the main thing that needs to happen is there needs to be more of an offensive as opposed to a defensive kind of thing, and yeah, more specifically kind of reaching out to, as you say, these precarious workers and traditionally non-unionized sort of sectors.
And I think this would actually be a good defensive strategy. I mean, I think a good offense is a good defense in this scenario, because if you start, you know, if we had precarious workers organized, there wouldn't be this stark contrast between public sector workers, let's say, and private sector workers, or unionized workers and non-unionized workers. And, you know, when there is such a huge contrast, it allows for these narratives of, you know, divisive narratives about what, you know, this person shouldn't be making so much, they're making too much, yada, yada, as opposed to, you know, trying to convince people that they ought to pull people down into the hole they're in, as opposed to pull themselves up you know, get together and put themselves up. So, you know, yeah, I think totally this is what I've encountered. I've called a lot of unions while trying to organize the wine rack and got no response. You know, I've left messages for organizers whose literally the job is to organize and don't get responses.
Do you have any kind of read on why that might be? Do you think it is just this whole thing about they're not interested in organizing precarious workers, or do you think it's something else?
Well, you know, it's hard to say. I don't want to be cynical and just be like, well, they're not going to get a lot of dues out of a low-paid local. So there's that. You know, it could be a losing proposition, right? They'll spend more money on grievances and campaigns for us than they'll actually get from dues, sort of thing. I mean, that might be part of it for some of the unions. There's also the whole story that I was already organizing with the SEIU, and I think a lot of unions are very reluctant to poach the territory of other, you know, unions. I mean, I have legitimate reasons to be pursuing another local. Or another union. So I don't know how much that plays into it, but I worry that that does play into it when I speak to other unions. They hear that I was organizing with somebody else and they just think, no, that's not our turf. So I don't know. It's hard to say. You know, when somebody doesn't call you back, there's not a lot of information you can read out of that.
Okay. So I guess that's kind of everything I wanted to ask. Do you have any kind of final closing things that you want to add to this discussion, which I think has been really good and I think has really hopefully informed people a lot about what's going on both in this particular instance, but also some insights for the nature of the labor movement moving forward. Do you have any final things to add?
Yeah, I think the one big point that should be made, and I'm always trying to make, I just did a drop-in introduction to the union to new TAs in one of the departments at Carleton just last week. And I always try to make this point. As I said, I'm studying left political strategy and inequality. And unions, they're so important. The biggest predictor of how equal a society is, in, at least within the Western world, is the rate of unionization in that society. It's the huge. There are other ways to achieve equality, and I think Japan's an example of that. Well, actually, no, they have a high rate of unionization as well. It's more, it doesn't have to be a big welfare state. I mean, the labor movement can play a big role. But the biggest predictor of how equal a society is in the Western world is the rate of unionization. And this is really important because how equal a society is has this massive impact that people don't really grasp, I think. And people on the left need to take it seriously. They need to take very seriously how important it is to, you know, build a more equal society, even if it means an incremental strategy. Because it does, there's this great study that Richard Wilkinson and Kate Pickett did, or book, really, that they wrote. Actually, Ed Broadbent recommended it to me, just to give a shout out to him for doing that. It's a great book, and it's inspired a lot of the research I'm doing now. It's this huge empirical study, and they demonstrate how basically every indicator of societal dysfunction you can think of is hugely correlated, tightly, positively correlated to inequality, to how unequal societies are. And it's to such an extent that it actually, you know, how equal or unequal your society is actually starts shaping people's views of their fellow citizens' human nature. It starts to shape people's perceptions of human nature and perhaps even their human nature itself. And I think that, you know, what that means in a broader context of left political strategy is that unionization is not some anachronistic institution that's hierarchical and should be dismissed for some sort of, alternative horizontal political space. It's very much integral to, I think, building the kind of society we want and to really an anti-capitalist political struggle, even if it's not that on the surface. It doesn't seem that way on the surface. And certainly it doesn't. I mean, go to an ODLC meeting and it doesn't feel like that. But it the impacts are manifold, and they happen. It's building a more equal society has a huge impact on the way we relate to each other and it opens spaces for transformational change that I don't think people are aware of, or they're not aware of the impact that it has on that. So, you know, this is what, it's a really hard conversation to have, especially on a picket line. But this is one of the things I try to point out to people, is that unions are really crucial. There's other ways to achieve equality, but they're one of the best ways we know of.
Okay. All right. Well, I think with that, we'll close up. I guess this was a bit of a different kind of episode of The Affairist Current, but I hope you enjoyed it all the same. If you want to give us feedback, theaffairistcurrent@gmail.com, affairistcurrent.blogspot.com for the show notes. We'll have links to everything Miles talked about today. And so with all that, I hope you enjoyed the show. For Miles and myself, I hope you have a great week.